meeting will come to order. Good morning. Welcome back. This being our first Operations Committee meeting since before the summer, really. We have an agenda that has been previously distributed. There are no changes to it. If there are no changes, then I'll ask unanimous consent that it be approved. Mr. Benjamin.
There is in the minutes a note that there will be a report on the NTSB requests.
Yes.
Those have now, of course, been updated with a more recent request. Are we going to get such a report? And if so, where is it in the agenda?
Well, of course, that report was requested, could be interpreted as a request for...
It was on actually the previous, what we were doing on the previous stuff.
No, I know, but it didn't say it would be on this committee's agenda. It said a report was requested, which I believe we received in writing. But if you would like one,
okay,
I'm sure the general manager would be happy to provide.
Yes, we did send to the board the written information from the NTSB, and Gerald Francis has a an overview of what those recommendations were.
Okay, so we'll include that. Any other suggestions? If not, hearing no objection, the agenda is accepted as presented. We do have the minutes of the July 16th meeting. Are there any corrections?
Approval.
Mr. Benjamin moves approval. Ms. Hewlett seconds. Any further discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Minutes are accepted as presented. We have a couple of action items and a number of information items. Let's move quickly to action item A, which is the Leesburg Pike Metrobus Improvements request to conduct public hearings. Mr. Cato, who will be handling this?
Mr. Victoria, we'll begin.
Good morning, Mr. Francis. Good morning, Mr. Victoria.
Good morning, Mr. Zimmerman. Mr. Zimmerman, the first two action items are a request of the board to approve public hearings for restructuring on two bus routes, one in Virginia and one Sears Mill in Maryland. I think the staffs have been briefed by our Metro team, Mr. Hambray, on the restructuring of what it is.
Let me just ask, both these items are simply requests to conduct hearings.
That's correct.
One of them is in Virginia and one is in Maryland. I wonder, Ms. Hudgens, what your pleasure might be on this one.
We can move approval.
Ms. Hudgens moves approval. Is there a second?
Second
by Mr. Nicola. Discussion. This is just item one. On item A. Is there any discussion? I mean, I think that we all understand what this is, and the interesting part comes after the hearing when you tell us what you're going to do.
Okay. Yes.
So with that, I think it's fine to go have a public hearing. All agree? Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That item is approved.
Thank you.
And item B is the similar for Beers Mill Road, and I wonder if someone from
move approval
has an opinion. Mr. Benjamin moves approval. Ms. Hewlett seconds. And if there's any discussion, not, again, look forward to the results of the hearing. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries.
I want to congratulate Mr. Hamry on an excellent presentation.
Thank you very much.
That's kind.
Thank you, Jim.
But the time.
All right. Moving on, item 4A is safety report. And I suppose this would be an appropriate time to relay to us anything significant involving NTSB.
Yes, sir.
To tell us this morning.
The safety, security, and service are processes that require continuous improvement, which is why it's important that we have the opportunity to speak to the board about the initiatives we are taking and their results. Before we hear the reports we have scheduled today, I want to discuss the NTSB's recent investigation update. Tuesday, the National Transportation Safety Board issued safety recommendations to Metro, the Federal Transit Administration, the Federal Railroad Administration, and Alstom Signaling. But the Federal Safety Oversight Agency still was not able to point to a cause of our June 22nd accident. The NTSB revealed that the track circuit equipment generated a false signal, which resulted in the train not being detected when it stopped in the track circuit where the accident occurred. The NTSB stated that the signal mimicked a valid track circuit signal, and as a result, the ability of the track circuit to detect the train was lost. It is important to note that the NTSB's recommendations could impact transit systems across the nation, and the NTSB specifically stated that it was concerned about the safety of train control system circuitry used in comparable rail and transit operations in other parts of the country. Prior to the release of the investigation update, Metro had already taken actions to implement the recommendations made to us. The NTSB recommended that we examine its track circuits that may be susceptible to sending false signals to eliminate the problem, and that we develop a program to periodically determine that electronic components in our train control system are performing properly. Our trains are being operated manually by train operators and will continue in manual mode until further notice. We also began addressing this recommendation the week of the accident when we started running twice daily computerized tests of all our track circuits, once after each rush hour, or 14 times a week. This computerized analysis identifies similar events so that track maintenance personnel can make any needed adjustments to the track circuits. If the analysis identifies a problem, the area of track is operated in what we call an absolute block, which means only one train at a time is permitted to be the designated area of the tracks. This is why our riders have experienced slower trips than they are accustomed to. Right now, we're operating at between Fort Totten and Tacoma. Additionally, we began work with a contractor, ERINC, and other outside vendors to develop a real-time monitoring system that will detect circuit failures and generate alerts. The second NTSB recommendation to us was to develop a program to periodically determine that electronic components in the train control system are performing within design tolerance. We are addressing these recommendations by working with Alstom Signaling, the manufacturer of the track signals that exhibited the failure, with another signal manufacturer, Union Switching Signal, to eliminate the problem identified. The NTSB investigation is not completed. We will continue to cooperate with the NTSB and respond quickly and hope that they can identify a root cause or causes that will allow us to put steps in place to prevent this from happening again.
Mr. Chairman, also, in addition, as a result of the recommendations from the NTSB, the American Public Transit Association, at its meeting in Orlando next week, is having special sessions and workshops that we will participate in some cases lead, so that the industry throughout the United States can work together to come up with solutions to the recommendations. But first, to analyze what we were told to do, to make sure everyone understands that, to ensure we have a consistent approach. Our staff will be going there to lead those discussions, but the impact is to transit systems in San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Atlanta, and other places. They are looking to us for some recommendations on what they should be doing. So we will take a far more active role from a national perspective leading this discussion next week.
Question? Ms. Bender.
I'd like to try to interpret what I thought I heard, just to make sure I heard it right, and then ask a couple questions about it. What I think I heard was the NTSB has not identified what the cause of the problem was, nor have they identified the solution to the problem. Is that right? They just identified the symptoms associated with it?
That's correct.
So this is sort of like going to the doctor and saying, I feel really, really bad, and here are all the things that I feel. And the doctor says, I can't tell you what disease you have. I can't cure it, but here are some things that can help your symptoms. Take a couple of aspirins. Is that sort of where we are? We're dealing with treating the symptoms? And do I understand correctly that the program that we have been using twice a day is a response to at least part of treating those symptoms?
Yes, it is.
And that the rest of the process is what we're working on, but nobody has a way of dealing with all of those other symptoms in a closed form fashion. They can't just come up and say, here's a solution, just go do it.
That's correct.
And so we're now, because lots of other people could be sick in exactly the same way, we're going to transit systems nationwide and working with them, trying to all work on this project where we're leading that charge.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So do we know how long it's going to take for any of this to work out and how much it's going to cost?
We know that we are working to develop a real-time detection system, and that process is underway. That will still take a few months. The total cost, I'm not sure what it is. From the standpoint of the recommendations from the NTSB, they've asked us to work with the manufacturer to do testing of our modules and work out some type of solution. So I'm not quite sure what that is, to be able to say what that's going to cost. And that's going to be part of the discussion that we're going to have in Orlando with the industry, to try to get our arms around specifically what is it that we have to do. It is frustrating from the standpoint, no disrespect intended, that, you know, we're well working on recommendations, but we're not certain because the NTSB very clearly said and not communicating that this was the absolute cause of the accident. They suspect that this is this contributed, but we're going to react, and we're going to respond, and we're going to do what we need to do to make this system as safe as possible.
So you're saying that there's another set of recommendations that may be coming down the line later to potentially look at the cure of the disease?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping sooner than later, and I'm making that assumption based upon the announcement that the NTSB released. When they specifically said they are not saying this was the cause of the accident, I assume that means we will get a report at some point in time that tells us specifically this is what it is and this is what you have to do.
So there'll be more. I'm sorry, go ahead.
But we're not going to wait. We're going to be working with the industry, still moving forward, working with the manufacturer, again, to address the issues that they have brought up, but continue to look at other things we can do to make the system safe. Ultimately, it will be the NTSB that says and notifies us and the public what the cause of the accident was.
When I read what the NTSB actually described, the little paragraph there that was extremely complex technically, my reaction was, how would anybody possibly, I mean, they did this after 3 months of 2020 hindsight, they managed to find this one very, very complex, highly unusual situation. Is this the kind of thing you would expect anybody to have recognized in advance? Is this the kind of thing that we could have even figured out?
It is, well, it's hard to figure out even what they said.
Is
not a terminology I use on a daily basis. And so I had to go ask someone, what does that mean? And they had a little section that kind of explained it that didn't help. No, it is not. It is even they had said, if you read the entire report, they really don't know what caused this. It's unusual. I did not see in that report that A went to B and B went to C and C went to D and this is what happened. So I don't know how you can anticipate something where 3 months later you still can't say what it was.
Okay. So after we've done all of this, we have a whole bunch of riders who know that we are trying at this point to treat the symptoms. Can we say to these riders that our system is safe?
Yes, we're making this system as safely as possible, as Mr. Francis communicated, what we're doing today. We're operating the system in manual mode. We're also running tests that would detect if there are any issues with any of the circuits. If we detect any, we immediately respond and put that segment of the track in an absolute block. What that means is we allow one train to go through at a time to make sure nothing can happen, so we do not have any possibilities of any collisions occurring. We also are working to develop an automatic detection system that would automatically detect it instantaneously 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That system doesn't exist, so it's being developed. I can't answer how soon that would happen. The sooner the better, of course, but we're working very actively on that. Again, we're going out, doing other tests within the system, a normal maintenance, as well as heightened maintenance. We have crews that are walking the tracks, our employees are very good in being able to assess the condition of our signals and our tracks, and they are out there on a daily basis monitoring that and inspecting that.
So would you say that the system is at least as safe, if not more safe, than for the 33 years before this accident?
I can't talk about every day of the 33 years. I can tell you that this system is as safe as you can make a system, humanly possibly make a system, and we have every resource in place to look and see if there are any problems and to ensure that it's safe. And we're taking actions like the absolute block. It is the extreme that you can pick when you detect any issue. And our standards for detection are far tighter than what they have been in the history of the agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. First of all, you prefaced your last comments with what we're doing today, but isn't it true that some of these, we've been working with the NTSB for a period of time since June 22nd, and we have implemented most or some of these recommendations prior to the report?
Yes. Given that we've been working with the NTSB, our staff, when anything came up during the investigation, began implementing
the manual modes,
the testing. Yes.
So
we didn't wait for the report.
Correct. That's what I'm
to begin implementing the recommendations. As soon as they had any concept that that might be an area, they began taking action.
The other thing I'd like to say is that I'm thankful that the NTSB at least brought this to, even though they don't have a final cause, at least brought it to the attention of everyone so that hopefully we can avert this kind of tragedy everywhere. So bringing this to the attention of all the transit agencies and all the railroad agencies so that this doesn't, for anybody who may have this type of problem or in these circuits, that hopefully we're all cognizant and that we can go down to APTA and lead this discussion so that everybody can be abreast of the steps that need to be taken so that this doesn't happen anywhere.
Excellent.
On the last point, I would just say that our brother and sister agencies have already been on notice, and they were on notice at the very beginning when the NTSB made the first announcement. I'm a little befuddled by this most recent announcement in light of the fact that, one, there's nothing new, and two, that there was a general alert to the industry to look at these issues when they made their first announcement going back several months ago. And since I'm out here regularly and talking to other agencies around the country, all of them have been both watching what's done here. They have actually taken that announcement to begin to examine their own systems. And they kind of recognize that we're kind of the poster child and taking all the fun in the direction, but they're sitting there watching everything that's going on so that they can respond for their own systems. So I don't find anything that was suggested in the new report actually being.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that it's not limited to this agency, and everybody is on notice, whether they were on notice as a result of the report or 2 months ago. Everybody's on notice, and hopefully this can avert this type of thing happening elsewhere.
Indeed, this, you know, this announcement came with four directives, essentially four different recipients besides us. As you mentioned, the Federal Transit Administration, the Federal Railroad Administration, and, you know, that's significant. One that governs all transit agencies in the country, and the other covers all the railroads that aren't transit agencies, which suggests the potential of a widespread problem, which obviously, you know, is a concern nationally. On the other hand, it also points to the perhaps obscure nature of whatever caused this. As you said, after 3 months, they're still not willing to say, we know what caused it.
Yes.
But we think we found something that's a problem that you need to address. But the fourth, those three letters all had something in common. They basically made the same pair of recommendations. And they all said, work with the manufacturer, a specific company, which was the recipient of the fourth letter. And that's Alstom.
Yes.
That obviously is a major provider in the industry as well as to this agency. And so they told all the three agencies, ours and the two national organizations, work with the manufacturer, and they told the manufacturer, work with these folks. So, did your phone ring?
From the manufacturer?
Yes, we heard from Alstom.
I'm going to ask Dave Kubicek. I've had discussions with him, but Dave has.
My phone has been constantly ringing. We've been on regular communication, not only with Alstom, but also with USS and several other vendors that are not even on this property at this point in time. And we are setting up...
And I understand the benefit of talking to anyone in the industry, but there's one specific company that's involved here.
Yes.
And that the NTSB said, you need to talk to these guys, and said to them, you need to talk to those guys. So, you are hearing from them?
Yes, sir. And we've been in conversation before those letters came out.
So you feel like you're getting good cooperation from this manufacturer?
We are working as aggressively as possible.
I have no doubt that you are. My question was, do you feel you're getting good cooperation from that?
At this point in time, our conversations, we have met with the head officials of Alstom. We have cut through a lot of the layers of the bureaucracy, and we are talking with the right people within their organization that are the decision makers.
Okay, I'll take that as promising then.
That's a good answer.
Thank you. Further questions?
I just like it, Mr. Chairman. I think that the message I hope that we will have the customers understand is that while we have a lot of information that's come from NTSB, we really are in the same place we were during the past several months now, and that the same urgency of safety is being conveyed. And I think NTSB is really just putting the emphasis on the importance and the complexity of this issue, and I think that that's the reiteration that needs to go out to our customers, that the system is secure, is safe, and that the safety of the system relies upon the implementation of steps that you've made up to date, and that will continue until we have actually a solution. I think too often the conversation publicly goes toward a solution to the problem. We don't need the solution to keep us safe, but it would be great to have a solution so that we can resolve where we are with the incident.
One other question. You were describing the measures that are being taken to ensure the safety, and including what are, in terms of normal operating procedure, sort of extreme measures, things like absolute block. And I think everyone understands the reason for that. That does, though, have an operational impact.
Yes.
In effect, reduces the capacity of the railroad.
Yes.
And are you yet able to quantify that?
We have reduced the number of trains.
That is correct.
Because we're operating both in manual mode as well as the absolute block. And Dave?
We are in the process of, specifically on the red line, we had to reduce it by about 5 to 6 train sets because whenever we institute this absolute block, we create a backlog of trains because it slows it down. So what we did to offset that is we created more 8-car trains to help increase our capacity of our consists going through there. We are in the process of trying to restore back to about 44 train sets of rail cars out there very soon. But we will still be in this manual mode, and if the need is called upon, we will have to implement, this absolute block if we see an anomaly that causes us concern. So it could slow it down.
Okay. So if I had asked you before June 22nd, for instance, what about the performance of the red line, you could have told me the red line's carrying X number of people per day, and you could tell me it has a theoretical capacity of X number of people today, and here's the actual performance, what we're getting. If I ask you that after June 22nd, obviously it would be different on June 30th than, August 30th. But can you translate that? I don't mean off the top of your head, but I mean, can you calculate that? Can you turn that into a number that reflects how many people a day you're capable of carrying, so how much capacity in that sense you've lost as a result of different measures you've needed to take?
Given some time, absolutely. We could run that number.
I think it would be useful for people to be able to understand how the different levels of measures you had to take, like, when you're single tracking and manual and absolute block, and when you have two tracks back, so that we can understand what's actually going on the red line specifically is the most directly affected, but then also system-wide, because, of course, manual and all these other things are affecting system-wide. Because one of the things we'll want to know as we look at ridership and all that is how much of it is attributable to other causes you know, any changes we see, and how much of it is being affected by the fact that we don't have as much railroad right now as we did before June 22nd.
Yeah, we can summarize, again, you know, like an extreme variable would be absolute block, so we would have to profile, you know, that type of condition. You know, starting out in the day, at manual mode, we have potential of X, but if we have to institute an absolute block at a certain area of the railroad, because it also depends on where we have to implement it at. You know, if it's an outlying area, it's less impact. If it's closer to the core, it definitely impacts us a lot more aggressively. So we'd have to layer that.
Well, I think it's important for us to understand that, okay, especially in light of all the focus we have to put on the capacity of the system, even apart from this, and what we need to do to have adequate capacity, and what we need to do to talk to other people about rail cars we need to buy, systems we need, and how that relates to how many people we can carry.
All right. Then, Mr. Zimmer, I'll add that into the report.
Okay. We get two pieces. I think we sent it to you earlier.
That's fine.
And have it published, but also to bring it back to this committee.
Yeah, it's going to be an ongoing issue. Mr. Ginkle.
Yeah, added to that, I'd like to see what our ridership is, you know, just kind of a trend of where the ridership has been on that particular line and other lines as a result of the crash and the reduction.
But
and that would tell us something as well. Also, I think I had asked previously at a earlier session about impacts on budget. You know, obviously we've spent a lot of overtime. Certainly the spotters and people that are at Fort Totten and Tacoma, whether they're still needed there, I don't know, but clearly that's a cost. Certainly all the costs associated with the repairs we had to do between those two stations, it'd be nice to see that as we approach the budget cycle, just to get a sense of where that number is.
We have been able to break down the costs. We do have that. We even have an analysis of the ridership. There are a couple of factors here. There's the accident, of course, had an impact, but it's also the factor, if you look at the number of tourists as well as the unemployment rate, there's been some impact to the ridership earlier. It seems to be recovering, though, but there has been some impact, and we're ready to give that report at the next Finance Committee meeting.
Okay. All right. With that, do you want to move on to the rest of your presentation on the side?
Yes, Ms. Samuels will do the SECI report.
Good morning. As Mr. morning. Francis has already since he's already commented on the latest NTSB, I would just like to take this opportunity to inform you that Metro is continuing to improve upon the safety for our passengers as well as employees. As you're aware, it is our number one priority for WMATA management frontline employees to make it as safe as possible. Today, I'd like to update you on some of the initiatives we've undertaken and look forward to continuing opportunities to share this progress with the committee. In the past, we've always reported on numbers, so I'd like to take this opportunity to inform on the initiatives that drive the numbers. Overall, Metro has taken steps to make a refresher training. Currently, right now, we have a right-of-way training to do a refresher right-of-way training course for all employees on all safety procedures mandatory for all employees who work in the field. We also implemented stricter hiring standards for all job applicants, including applications for frontline and safety-sensitive positions. Additionally, some quality assurance staff has been assigned to my department to assist me in conducting comprehensive safety checks throughout the rail and bus system. We're also making organizational changes in my department to strengthen within the ranks of the department. Specifically with to rail, although most of the current safety performance indicators which reflect the decrease in most categories listed, the June 22nd accident, of course, has had an impact on that, whereas 80% of the 80 injuries, were as a result of that accident. We're continuing to strive through making those improvements in rail specifically. The safety department, as well as operations, we've held numerous stand-downs where we meet with managers and frontline employees to review all safety procedures. And in fact, during some of those meetings, we actually developed new procedures as a result of the discussion that was held between us and the frontline employees. We've also increased the number and frequency of worksite inspections, including safety checks at all track maintenance, at all work sites, and during the nighttime, which is where we have a lot of our employees working on the railroad. We're continuing to meet with the track maintenance personnel to review the work procedures and rules as well. As Mr. Cato has mentioned in previous conversations with you all that we are monitoring track circuitry profiles immediately after every rush hour, twice daily, and immediately addressing any circuit anomalies identified. Also, because of the increase in suicides in the rail system, we are researching the development of a multifaceted approach to look into the reduction of the suicide prevention program. Our medical EAP is taking the lead, and our Transit Police Department will be assisting them with that. Specifically, some of the initiatives we've taken on the bus side of the house is that we've increased communication to our bus operators via bus safety advisories. On a monthly basis, we typically put out safety bulletins on a variety of topics. As an incident occurs, we put out an alert, so that way all employees are informed on the front line. Metro has also adopted a defensive driving system known as the Smith system, which is used by other safety conscientious corporations like UPS, for example, just to name one. That's now being incorporated into the training of the operators that works on enhancing the driver skill techniques. To date, we've actually had 6 bus training instructors have 100% completed the Smith system course. Also, my department has partnered with bus in putting an increased focus on certain locations where we have a higher number of accidents. So we're doing safety observations. We're out on the front line and seeing how those accidents occur and using that information to assist us in defining training. We're also in the process of updating, revising, and expanding the scope of our official Metrobus employee handbook, which serves as the rule book for employees as their standard operating procedures. On to Metro Access. Within the past month, I guess, well, since we've met, the AGM, Mr. Christian Kent, and myself also met with MVs, our paratransit contractor, with their president and their senior corporate safety person to discuss the expectations of safety. Although they are a contractor, we would like them to have the same rules and procedures and guidelines and strict adherence to the same rules that we are promulgating throughout the other side of the operation house. We also have a departmental safety committee where we address issues and discuss any items that employees and or passengers bring up to our employees in Metro Access. And then we also have a wheelchair securement committee where we use that to develop protocols to assist us in changing and or modifying how our bus operators are taught to handle passengers when boarding their bus. And that concludes my report, so I'll answer any questions you may have.
Just to look at the numbers, if I start with the last one in the appendix on Metro Access, the top line and the third or bottom line relate to one another. I gather the top line is in effect the numerator in the calculation on the. Oh no, that's on. Yeah. So that's the number of injuries. The third one is number of injuries divided by millions of passenger miles. That gives you a rate. Right?
That's correct.
So in other words, when we look at the top line, we see there were in fact more an absolute number of injuries that was higher than the previous year, but the number of Metro Access grew so much, the number of miles traveled went by up a lot.
That's correct.
So that, in fact, the injury rate is almost unchanged.
Yes. And so in the past, also, we used to measure Metro Access by 100,000 miles. And based on their increased ridership, we've now
changed the scale.
Exactly.
Because of the tremendous increase in usage. And the collision rate went down slightly. It's not a big change, but it went down.
15%.
And on the bus side, all the categories that you've measured here, from passenger injuries to preventable collisions, non-preventable collisions, the injury rate, all of them went down.
Yes.
And on the rail side, there's the obvious fact of
June 27th.
One very terrible day.
Yes.
But if we look across, it's interesting. Escalator injuries is something we focused a lot on in previous years, and that looks like a pretty significant reduction.
Yes.
It's almost 25% lower, and it's a lot lower than it was 2 years ago.
That's true.
So, from one year to another, you can just get a fluke or something, but it kind of looks like that's pretty, it's like half as many as we had on escalators 2 years ago.
Yes. And we, We're doing numerous things with Mr. Dave Lacoste on the operations side in terms of creating stickers and decals that go on the escalator, handing out pamphlets regarding escalator safety, and just making folks aware of how to stop an escalator in case of emergency. So it's actually had a great impact on the reduction of the numbers.
Can you attribute? I mean, there's a number of reasons you have, you know, incidents. I mean, one might be passenger behavior.
Yes.
And that might be corrected to some degree by modifying people's behavior. But there also been changes like the safety devices on the escalators have increased over time. I know there's something I saw visit this last year with the, how the chrome plates
done. Chrome plates.
You have kind of two sets of sensors now, where one time you had one. Can you tell how much of the change is the result of having, you know, a difference in mechanism, and how much is the result of changes in what people are doing? Is that discernible? Mr. Lacoste?
My response to that is has to be that most of the reduction in injuries is because of the safety features that we've added to the escalators. I still have not seen a significant change of behavior, and the number of incidents, and from my perspective, is still up there.
You're still not satisfied.
Right, but the number of, I think, incidents that turn into actual, you know, real injuries with claims has gone way down.
So it sounds like you're saying we've done just about everything we can do in terms of making the mechanism safer and having, you know, safety features, fail safes, and that kind of thing. To make more progress, we also have to find more ways to do what
patron awareness
was just talking about and make people more aware of.
Yeah, well, there's always room for improvement, yeah. But we've done this, you know, we've made a significant amount of progress with the equipment safety, but we still have a long way to go on the behavior.
I often think that people aren't necessarily aware. I mean, I think we've become generally, as members of the public, casual about, you know, an escalator. I remember when Mrs. Hanley used to serve here, she talked about, you know, when we were kids and, you know, you held your mother's hand and, you know, people were kind of a little bit more intimidated by escalators at one time, and with good reason. And they were a lot less safe, actually, than they are now. They've become safer, and we've become more casual about it, which, of course, can lead to other problems. But one of the things I think that people probably aren't aware of is the number of safety devices that are included and the consequences of that. Again, everything we do that improves safety tends to have some impact on performance. And the things that help make, that avert escalator injuries, basically are things that shut the escalator down.
Right.
And you have incorporated more and more things that will shut the escalator down. And a lot of people don't realize how easy it is, inadvertently, to cause the escalator to stop. And then for many of these things, you then need to have a mechanic go out, open the thing up, and flip a switch. And all that has to be handled very carefully because of the safety concern. But that reflects then when people say, well, why isn't the escalator working? Part of that is a matter of the safety. So I'm glad that this has come down a lot. And I'm hoping we can get it down further. But I do think that educating the public is really important, both so that they understand that we do have some responsibility for our own safety, and we can never eliminate all these unless people, you know, are careful. But also that they understand the impact of what people's behavior on the escalator may have on their riding experience, because that is a not insignificant reason for escalators not functioning. Do you disagree?
Oh, I agree.
I also noticed that smoke incidents were down significantly. Again, this is something that was a really big issue a few years ago. It's not zero, but it does seem to be improving. Again, you think this is the result of practices?
Yes. We have the on the right of way, as we've mentioned before, the trash collector receptacles, which have helped a lot, as well as our employees being more aggressive and putting out fires and addressing them initially, along with the station managers as well.
Very good.
Yeah, Mrs. Zimmerman, I'd like to add, too. I'd like to speak, because I think, you know, it started with our employees, and Dave, Mr. Kubitschek might correct me on the numbers, but we had a big initiative going on, and my hat goes off to our track employees, because they literally got trash bags and started picking up any and everything that was on their right-of-way, and that started the program going on, and since that time, they've done an excellent job of maintaining it as well.
Thank you, Mr. Benjamin.
I'd like to pick up basically where Mr. Zimmerman left off. Mr. Pinckney Samuels, you mentioned that basically we have an extremely good record in terms of safety. And without in any way taking away from the accident that occurred, which was horrendous on June 22nd, what I thought I heard you say is if those 80 injuries were not included in these statistics, we would be down to 48 injuries.
That's not nine.
So we would have gone from 161 to 113 to 48. So that gives us some indication of, excluding that one horrendous situation, how safe the rest of the system really is, or how safe the system is, not including that one incident. And then practically all of these numbers are negatives, particularly in the very big ones. And I noticed the same thing as Mr. Zimmerman pointed out in the bus. Every number isn't a negative. And then in Metro Access, basically, it says when adjusted for ridership, there's no change. In the bus category, if there are pedestrian injuries, are they shown in here somewhere?
They get, well, no, the actual bus pedestrian injuries do not. However, in order to create the number of preventable bus accidents, that information is counted as the letter N on the formula.
It shows up in either preventable,
that's correct.
Or non-preventable if it's non-preventable.
Right.
It may be useful for us to know whether that's a number that's going up or down. It's a significant issue for us.
Sure.
And I assume that fatalities are included in injuries in all of these numbers?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to go back to the point of trying to get to the behavior part, because the numbers are really great. The progress that I think you're making in terms of the system as a whole being safe and the parts that you've addressed, and how do we get, what is our message that we need to get to the users? Because the impact on these, on the larger system, becomes a larger disruption many times. And so that's where the customers see the impact. But the question is, and I would analogize it to seatbelt safety. We know that we're safe when we wear it, and for some reason it's become an automatic that your certain action results in either you making yourself safer or just simply putting yourself in peril. And it's that part, as Mr. Zimmerman was pointing out about the escalator or other things of that nature, that I think we need to work on a graphic that highlights the behavior and what that behavior means, because you see it every day in the system and you kind of wonder, what does it take to connect that? If you continue to do that, you will be injured, but the whole system becomes disrupted as a result of it, which takes a great toll on the service delivery part. And I see it sometimes and I wonder, well, why would someone do that? But for some reason, the connection is not being made that they really are putting themselves at risk as well as disruption to the system. And I don't know, because these numbers really reflect a great deal of work on the part of the staff. But we always say we have our partners in as customers in the system, and that's going to be really important.
All right, let's move on to 4B. We'll need to pick up the pace a little bit.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, other members of the committee. I thank you again for allowing the Metro Transit Police the opportunity to come and share with you some of the initiatives that we have been participating in, as well as providing you with some updated crime statistic information. The first slide that you see depicts what happened starting January 2009, where a subject began calling in threats via the 911 call centers to 21 stations that had an impact on the District of Columbia in Maryland. The subject was later charged by a federal grand jury with 5 counts of willfully making threats, maliciously conveying false information, using fire and explosive, and faces up to 10 years in prison. This person, through the help of the Criminal Investigation Division and one of our patrol officers working with a host of federal agencies, Metro Access, who this person happens to have had an access card, did a wonderful job in bringing this to a close. And we have Detective Honig, Detective Frost that are here, if you would stand up. These are the detectives that work closely, tirelessly, to bring this person to grand jury indictment. The second slide sort of depicts the special police hiring and training. As we all know, the special police are the first line of our defense in most WMATA facilities, and especially this one here at the Jackson Graham building. And so we sort of ramped up an extensive 80-hour course that covers a variety of different issues that they'll be faced with. Part of this group also represents the 14 new special police officers that will, as a result of the FTA and providing additional security to those bus divisions, be those new special police. So we applaud those efforts of our training division and the people who participated in that particular effort. The next slide is the latest juvenile initiative that comes out of our patrol division. We have details at roughly 12 stations that we experience the most problems with juvenile problems in Maryland and the District of Columbia. This, again, is a collaborative effort with the Metropolitan Police Department, the D.C. Public Schools, our Transit Police, and we work tirelessly in identifying those stations that we have problems with, the Minnesota Avenue, the Tinley Town, other stations throughout the jurisdictions, in an effort to prevent kids from getting into trouble, from fighting, things of that nature. They also participate in a daily conference call that's held by all of those agencies that I've mentioned earlier in an effort to work in a collaborative fashion. The next slide is depicts the Office of Emergency Management. It's a department that was created in December of 2008 with the mission and vision of prevention through training and outreach for special projects preparedness, response, recovery. They've done an excellent job just since January of 2009, provided over 1,000 local, state, and federal first responders, worked closely with all of the jurisdiction, police, fire, and rescue, and is working to, prevent, prepare, and response and recovery efforts for this Washington Metropolitan Transit System. And I might add that this is one of the first Office of Emergencies for transit agencies across the country. This next slide depicts, as an increase in our robberies, we've had a rash of robberies involving the stealing of iPods and things of that nature. And starting in May, we assembled a group of officers who worked tirelessly to go out into these stations that had been identified as problem areas, and these officers, in a short period of time, accounted for over 50 individuals' arrests for robbery-related crimes. They also had the opportunity to have the Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia work with them on several of occasions, and she had glowing comments about their professionalisms and things of that nature. And I would ask them briefly to stand up. This is just a few of the officers. We have three that are also working with the City of Pittsburgh and the G20 Summit, but they've done an outstanding job. So thank you. This next slide depicts the bus operators' assaults, and we can say that the assaults on bus operators for this same period in 2008 is down 22%, and that is also a concerted effort with our Metro Bus Enforcement Division, paying attention, going out to the respective bus divisions, meeting with the superintendents, working with Milo Victoria in an effort to report and identify those targeted routes that have a tendency to have assaults that are taking place. The last slide that I will talk about is that we again like to stress the probability of being a victim of a Pod 1 crime in the metro system, and that is 2.52 for every million customers. And we also want to highlight that during 2009, we've had over 989 arrests. We've had about 28,000 calls for services, and we've issued over 3,100 criminal citations and wrote over 1,600 fare evasion citations. So the officers, men and women, in addition to other duties and responsibilities, are out there trying to get the job done.
That's my report, sir.
When you say the probability of being the victim of part one crime are the ones that scare people.
Absolutely.
And that looks like a really small number and a really big number, but that doesn't really give a lot of context. I mean, how does that compare to something else?
Okay.
What's my probability if I'm walking down the street or?
Well, recently the Montgomery County issued a report that highlighted for a 3-year period that there were 72,000 reports of part one crimes for that 1 year, compared to about 258 crimes associated with metro parking lots in Montgomery County. So you have 72,000 versus 258, so the probability of being a victim in the metro system, even in those jurisdictions that we operate in, is very low.
Ms. Benjamin.
Yeah, I'm trying to do the same thing, put this into some sort of context. All the jurisdictions do report part one crimes, right?
Right, yes, sir.
If you had a crime per capita number, which is about the same as a crime per rider number, part one crime, order of magnitude for, I'm not sure that that exactly matches, but it gives me some idea. Order of magnitude, would this 2.52 be higher, lower,
Very, very much lower.
Very, very much lower. So what we're saying is the probability of being a victim of a part one crime in any one of our jurisdictions is substantially higher outside of our system than in our system.
Absolutely, sir. Absolutely.
And that furthermore, when you look at the next chart that has all of the numbers, the preponderance of those, as I think you pointed out, was people stealing cell phones and iPods and breaking into cars and stealing cars.
Absolutely. Okay. And what we will have for the next meeting is a breakdown of crimes against person versus crimes against property, because even those non-vehicle related, how we have it depicted, does not speak to whether or not something is actually involves a person. And so we'll have that for the next presentation.
So we're saying our system is exceptionally safe, and you know, if you're scared out on the street, run into our system, it's safer.
We have a very safe system. One crime is one crime too many, but we make a concerted effort to protect our employees and our patients.
Step two clause.
Well, I mean, this is the difficulty, that on the one hand, we want to make sure that everyone is vigilant, that they don't are casual. You do have to be, you know, aware of your surroundings and thinking about what you're doing, where you're going, anywhere in our large society. And we don't want everybody to think that, you know, there's no risk of anything. There's always some degree of risk.
Absolutely.
And there are crimes that occur. On the other hand, we want people to keep that in perspective, that this is a place like any other in which you need to be careful.
Right.
But in fact, the crime rate here is, if anything, lower than you are likely to encounter in most of the other places you go during your day.
Yes,
for
sir.
Most people, that is probably true.
To this particular item, I think the real emphasis is on the fact that it's relative to where crime is. And too frequently we hear people say that transit brings crime to a community. And that's really not the issue. It's really what is the criminal environment within the area where you're going. And that it is the transit system as almost an entity to itself as to how it's affected by crime.
Yes.
It's outside of the areas that we travel.
Looking at this data, if you wanted to give a simplistic response, you'd say parking lots bring crime.
That's really the biggest part for transit. That's the biggest part of it. It's not about the crime in the community. Yes, and that's a piece. Can I go back to my? I just wanted to highlight something, and I know that you've worked on this because, as you brought it before, on the juvenile issue. There was a comment, I think, from Mr. Zimmerman, and I'm still working on it, because I'd like to emphasize that our juveniles can be our best customers.
True.
When they're well-behaved. And I think we need to convey a more positive message on this, because I still think we're defining juveniles as a problem. They aren't the problem, it's their behavior, and when that behavior in the transit system, it impacts all of the customers. So I hope you can keep working on that.
Absolutely.
And I just have a thing that we have to convey a more positive message about the juveniles.
We are working with the principals at the various schools. We're coming in doing outreach efforts, so we do make a concerted effort to have them understand that the system belongs to their parents, that they pay tax money for the systems, and we expect them to act accordingly.
The message, that it's
I'd like it to be thought of that when I see a juvenile, I shouldn't have to become alert to the problem that they're going to be, but rather that I'm looking for behavior that's unacceptable, and it just happens to be a juvenile at the time. Granted, we have more of that as a problem, but if we start out on a little different way, maybe we can have even juveniles looking out for the problem that their colleagues or their peers create, and it is a problem.
And it isn't all of them.
It is. It isn't
most of them. It's some kids.
That's it, yeah.
But, you know, I think the vast majority of kids who ride on transit are, in fact, well-behaved customers. So, you know, since you opened this, Ms. Hudgens did hear a comment from me on this at one point, which is what you're referring back to. You know, I do have some concern about the way we may approach it. Now, I don't actually know what you're doing. The stuff you're doing sounds like it's good stuff. But the language of it, I think, did jump out at us. I would say, using the word juvenile, which for most people is a modifier that goes before the word delinquent, is immediately setting, you know, a certain tone to the thing. You know, we're talking about kids. And since having done some work with kids, trying to get kids on transit, we had a big initiative to get kids on transit in my county, and we worked directly with them. We created a teen transit council, and we got their suggestions, got their feedback. We did a lot of surveying kids and asked them what they thought. Why do you use it? Why don't you use it? And, you know, it was striking to me the number of responses from kids who said that they viewed, you know, like buses as hostile places. And for specifically, that bus drivers were hostile to them. And now, when I started looking at the number of incidents that bus drivers deal with that happen to involve kids, I understood the dynamic we got going on both sides. So I could understand why a bus driver would immediately be suspicious when he sees a group of kids. But also know that most groups of kids are not the ones that are going to create the problem, and they all feel like they're, you know, so it's not a simple thing, obviously. And you are dealing with a real problem, and that's important you're dealing with it. But I think Ms. Hudgens is right that we have to find ways that, you know, reach out to kids, the majority of whom are good customers. We want them to be our customers. And, you know, having a close relationship with, you know, your community is, as you well know, important to being able to effectively do your job.
Absolutely.
Is there somebody else? So that you were.
Well, I'm trying to avoid this, but I think, you know, you keep looking at me and asking me now.
Well, you were like, you're about to say,
keep looking like you're going to say.
I'm also, but, you know, there is another aspect of this. I mean, I think that there are also kids who feel intimidated by kids on transit as well.
Yes.
I think that even though it's a small number of individuals, the same kids that you sometimes want to use public transportation, their response is, There are bullies, there's uncontrolled group that's there. I feel a lot more comfortable when mom and dad is chauffeuring me in a car because I'm in a protective environment. Once I get out there in the transit system, then there is this uncontrollable force that's there where I am, in fact, potentially going to be a victim. And even though there are small numbers of those, the ones that are small tend to get a lot of attention. You can be in a car full of quiet, obedient, well-behaved adults and children. You can have one, two juveniles, and it takes over the entire car. So that
you've been a parent.
Yes. So that perception, you know, is what creates the problem. So, you know, I understand we're trying to communicate, you know, that it is an exception and it's not the rule. But it's such a loud, vocal, active reality there that creates some real problems.
No disagreement here. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, item C is Metro Rehabilitation.
Metro Rehabilitation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we had a discussion about is what I wanted to kind of put on the agenda for a placeholder is to kind of give the committee a 90-day look ahead on all the rail rehab projects that are going to be taking place and focus in on the major closures of stations such as 4th of July, Labor Day, and so forth. We have two major projects coming up for Columbus Day, but our annual Yellow Line Bridge inspection that will be going on, as well as us doing some work at La Pond Plaza, interlocking, once again, like the Pentagon, changing out switches and making the number 8 guarded switch switch turnouts there. The system will be closed from 9:30 p.m. on Friday, and we'll reopen again at Tuesday at 5 a.m., which will have an effect on stations from Waterfront, Southeastern to Navy Archives. Also wanted to let you know that the internal communication has started as well as the external communication. The internal meetings have been ongoing. We had a big meeting yesterday to talk internally about what we're doing between bus and rail and our infrastructure teams and media. The external media, we already had a media release go out on September 1st, and there'll be additional news releases going out the next couple of weeks. Our MIPS, our Metro Information Personnel, you know, we're gathering them and coordinating them based on some of the recommendations we have from the committee on Labor Day, making sure that we communicate between our service operation managers as well as our road operation managers and station managers, because it was time we were running shuttles. We heard comments that we were running shuttles and sometimes they get behind schedule, and making sure that they're making our rail service as well. Signage will go up. I think it starts on Monday or the middle of next week. So we are making sure that we have the external communication out there, and we'll continue to do the same internally. We'll have another meeting next week to discuss any pros and cons. And then what I'd like to also do is come back in the October meeting to let you know how the Columbus Day operation went. One other thing I'd like to focus on, too, or comment on, we have a major rehab project in Franconia, Springfield for the parking garage. It's going to take place on October the 1st. And Mr. McKay is not here, but one of the things I wanted to mention is the fact that, or thank him, his office and team worked together with Metro's team to make sure that we got the information out to our customers on that end of our rail system, as well as looking for alternatives where our customers could park and what they could utilize in bus shuttles. This is going to be an 18 to 20 month project, so we wanted to make sure that we got the information out, and we wanted to also make sure that we were providing service to some of the customers that might be impacted by this rehab project. So again, I will come back to the next committee and give you a post update on how the Columbus Day weekend went.
Very good. Any questions? All right. Next item D is an update on next bus.
Yes, good morning again.
Morning, Mr. Victor.
A couple of months ago, we launched the next bus arrival prediction system, and it has been very successful. I know that you wanted us to give you an update on this date, and what I want to do is talk with you about what has happened in the last 2.5 months, actually. If you look at the first slide, first I'd like to thank Sarah Wilson's group for that beautiful ad that you probably have seen on our buses, and it really depicts where Metrobus is going. So what we've done in the last couple of months is we've set up a management system for the next bus, and we've developed performance reports. These reports look at a number of interactions, like complaints, status of the signs, operator log-ons, radio repairs, etc. We've also developed the service standards for addressing complaints and completing repairs. Whenever we received a complaint of a sign that needs to be repaired or an issue with NextBus, we strive to complete it within 48 hours and get back with the customer, let them know that it's been completed. We've also reviewed and evaluated the trends such as usage, the types of complaints that we're getting, the equipment status, things of that nature. During that first month, what we did is we did quite a bit of quality assurance with the signs, and we looked at all 12,000 of our signs. We figured out how many needed still some repairs or changes or were inaccurate, and gave it back to the vendor to repair, And as of this date, the vendor has repaired all of the ones that they were responsible for, and we've done a punch list for the ones that the agency is responsible for. It's approximately 300 of them where the pole may have been missing or some other problem may have arisen. If we go to the next page, one of the other things that was done during the first 2 months is that our quality assurance personnel actually changed checked thousands of predictions to ensure that the system is working as is designed to work, and I'm happy to say that that number is just about 100%. The other thing that we're doing consistently is that every week we have a meeting with all the stakeholders to ensure that our radios are working correctly, that our mapping is and scheduling is done correctly, and that everything matches, and that we are following up on any issues with NextBus. So as you can see, we're very committed to the long-term success of this. On the next page, you can see our usage, and what this slide shows is what has happened in the first 2 months. And you can see that we've had 452,372 interactions. And out of those, there have been 136 complaints. You can see that the complaints were higher in July. And as we repaired some of the sign issues, the complaints went down. As of the beginning of this week, for September, we've had approximately 160,000 interactions with only 13 complaints. So the complaints continue to go down. Some of our challenges, schedule changes. We should have two system picks a year, three at one of our divisions, and often we end up doing four and some other picks in between, some other schedule changes in between. And what happens is whenever we that takes place, we have to reload the entire system, which gives potential to errors being loaded. So four of our nine divisions, all the buses have to be loaded manually, and that creates that potential for errors. The majority of our radios are 7 years old, sometimes older. The lifespan for these radios is 3 to 5 years, so they're in need of replacement. And we have a three-year replacement plan for that. Vandalisms. I wanted to show you some of the things that we're faced with. This is some of the things that we're finding. Our signs may be vandalized. This one was found out in the street. This one here, somebody made this one for me, for my tacos. Put some legs on it and use it as a taco holder. That's my souvenir. We also, one of our other challenges is really training all of our service operations managers and other managers to ensure that the system is used properly, because some of the side benefits that we have from instituting NextBus is that we can use this as a management tool. And if we go to the next page, I can talk about that a little bit. Under the first bullet, one of the things that we are having to do is consolidate all of our bus stop databases. We have four, actually, and they don't all necessarily match. So we are consolidating to have one master so that the planning, scheduling, IT, and NextBus all work off of the same database that shows all 12,000. Some of the other tools that we're asking for from NextBus and will be developed by NextBus is that instead of a report, for example, we can only tell if a bus is predicting, but we can't tell why it's not predicting, and so it will be requesting some of those reports. Service operations managers will be able to request a vehicle report of all the routes assigned to them, and which ones have been running late, which ones are early, They can also request a report to see which of the buses have been bunching and analyze the trends, because we'll have the capability of looking at the history and requesting a report right from the service operation manager's vehicle. We're also going to be requesting some reports that we can share and work with the customer service department to work with the CRM to assist in responding to the complaints. And we're also asking NextBus to give us monitor alerts whenever there's a problem with the system, that they can do real-time reporting to us what the issues were. And that concludes my report. We're very happy with the system.
Mr. Vittori, when you look at the complaints, you noted that there were 136. What were the nature, what's the pattern of the complaints? What are most people complaining about?
I can tell you that the first month, the majority, vast majority of the complaints were signs missing or installed in the wrong location.
Okay, sign-related.
Sign-related. Okay. And so those, as we repair those, as we get the calls and we repair them, the complaints have been going down. You can see the next month, October, it's lower. Same nature. What we're seeing in September is that since we're almost done with all the signs, what we're seeing is a customer may call and say, the system predicted my bus was going to be here at a certain time, and it didn't show up for half an hour later. There were actually 5 complaints like that, and the problem was that the bus broke down, or there was some issue in between where the prediction was made and the time that it was supposed to arrive. Our customer doesn't know that.
And we'll never be able to fix that, obviously.
Exactly. And so 5 of those and 6 that were very similar. So 13 complaints so far.
Okay, so that kind of thing is always going to be with us until we have crystal ball perfectly. But, and they're very small. Mm-hmm. It's a very small number. But what about the situations? I mean, this to me, and I have to say, as a bus rider, this is one of the best things that ever happened to me. So, you know, and I think it's, in my experience, it's working very well. I'm using it a lot. Everybody I hear from, everybody I talk to, is enthusiastic about this. The one issue that was a problem the first time we tried doing this, and to the extent that there's been a problem, it's the only one I've encountered. I've only encountered it once, but, you know, it's the issue, which is a bus not being on the system, that, you know, you don't have a prediction for it. In my experience, when it predicts, it's been really accurate as far as when a bus comes. But when a bus isn't, for one reason or another, on the system, you don't know that it's there, so you see, well, there's not a bus coming for 20 minutes when there might be one coming in 4 minutes.
And it shows up.
So that's the question I have is, you know, what? How do we know about that? And do you have data on the percentage of buses that, or the number of incidents where the bus doesn't show up and why that is? Because, again, the first time around, one of the issues was whether drivers were logging on properly. And, you know, or is there some other kind of thing that leads to this? Again, I don't know that the number's very high, but I think it's an important thing for us to be monitoring and knowing the number.
I can tell you that the number is very low, and part of the issue is the in order for the system to work correctly, several systems have to be aligned, and one of them is the GPS antenna. GPS antennas have a
lifespan.
On the bus. Mm-hmm. They have a lifespan of 3 to 5 years also. And they have an internal battery. What happens is the battery eventually dies. Mm-hmm. And so we are in the process of replacing all of the antennas. So far, we've replaced over half of the fleet. And we have a plan to replace the rest of them within the next 3 months. And once that happens, you'll see even less of those complaints or those instances where the bus wasn't reporting at all.
So we have we'll have an ongoing maintenance issue, because you have to on some cycle replace that equipment, batteries have to be replaced, and
correct.
Presumably that's to be incorporated into regular routine here.
It is.
Or we wake up one day and all of a sudden things work and they say, oh, we should have been replacing batteries. You're not going to let that happen, obviously.
No. We have a plan, and that is part of the maintenance cycle as well. And we're also doing a lot of work with some of the things that we found, for example, that our bus operators, it seemed like they were not logging on, when in fact they were, but we didn't know that they needed to log on after each block. In other words, if a block ended with an operator's lunch break, after the lunch break they needed to log on again. And so those are some of the things that we were finding out and were correcting as we go.
Okay, so in future, I think it would be good for us to see, you know, kind of the number of these problems.
Sure.
And how they break down from transponders that were broken or a battery problem versus an operator issue and, you know, how that can be corrected.
Correct. We have that, and we'd be happy to show you that.
And I think it'll be important for us to understand that.
Okay.
I had another question, and that has to do with how this system can be extended in ways that be even more useful for customers. And mostly that has to do with how people could plug into the data that's being generated, the information that's out there. I'm told that there are bars in Portland, Oregon, where they actually have digital displays that show when, in that case, it's the Portland streetcar that's used as the next bus. And so you could be sitting there and know right up until, you know, when the thing's coming so you can run out and catch your streetcar. We heard sometime in the last year about something in Chicago. Somebody had developed an application that would call your cell phone. You set for my bus, I want this bus, but then I want to know 2 minutes before it's coming or something, and it tells you, you know. I don't know, sends you a text message or whatever it is. But these were things being done by outside third parties tapping into the information and making it more generally available. So the question is, can we do that here?
I tell you what, I will work with our IT department and do some research and see what's available. And see what
I'm told that there is something from my wonky friends in the tech world, something called an API. I do not understand what this is. I know they will try to explain to me again. I fear I will still not understand. But apparently it's really important if you want to be able to make third parties able to tap in and, you know, and use this sort of thing. So I would request that, Mr. Cato, you look into that, because I think to the extent that we can leverage this to increase the communications out there, to increase the accessibility of the system, and it will increase awareness. I mean, imagine the impact. If somebody could have a digital display that showed something like this in a fireplace, it means all the people in there who aren't using the thing say, what's that? And that's cool. And, you know, you could pick up customers that way, too. So, you know, I just hope we can explore all these possibilities and make the most of it. Mr. Lynn.
Hope we get some licensing agreements as well so that we can get some revenues at the third parties. That's a whole other issue.
And I think that precisely is an issue we need to discuss. And while it's always good to be looking for how we can make any revenue we can to offset the cost of subsidies and fares, I would be ashamed to get ourselves so tied up in what might not be a significant revenue stream that we miss the larger thing. Getting a customer on who pays a fare to fill a bus that's not full could be worth a lot more to us potentially than some of these things. And many of these kind of applications aren't necessarily making a lot of money for anybody. I mean, I think, you know, the one example that I heard of is, you know, like some graduate student basically does it as a hobby. And, you know, they do it for fun. And somebody sometimes makes money on some of these things, and a lot of them don't. But there's our fundamental business here is providing transportation. And to the extent that we can do that better and get more customers, I think that's where our emphasis ought to be, in my opinion. Questions?
That is our fundamental business, and we don't do the business unless we have revenues to support it. And so that is our fundamental business. And my experience has always been is that we tend to underestimate and overlook the revenue implications of this. And case in point was NextBus, or not NextBus, but when we were looking at the idea that we have our car rental services, and I suggested that we explore it. And we always, what I heard was this was a service that we provided to our users, but just by exploring it, we found out that there was some opportunities for revenue. So I'm always suggesting that we always need to look and not assume that just because you're providing service that somebody's not generating income. And since I'm on the other side of this equation, I know how people are out there generating rent income, and they also go to transit agencies, which I have supported for my entire career, always begging for money, yet they don't value their resources, and others do, who are lining their pockets. So I will finish my comment.
I think you make an important point, and this is the discussion which I do think we need to have more in this agency. But I would point out, though, that I think your example is instructive, because you were talking about car sharing. And we started that, basically, we just provided the space, and we didn't get any money back from it. And more recently, we have been able to make arrangements that do provide us some money back, as you indicated. And I think it was important to push for that at that point. But I'd also say that when they first walked in here to do car sharing, there wasn't any money to be made. Nobody was making any money. And it was important to get it seeded and started to where now somebody can make money on it, and we can share some of it as well. And it would be a shame to not get it. I mean, if nobody's doing it, then nobody's making any money on it. So I think it's very important to protect our long-term interests, and I, you know, I certainly agree with you that we have to make sure that if there's assets that are valuable, we're using them for all the reasons you say. But again, if it doesn't get started, if it doesn't happen, then there's no value created. And I think we need to find a way to get these things started. And you know, in the long term, if there's a flow of revenue that's significant, and we should be tapping some of it. But you know, it doesn't necessarily happen if we don't help stimulate it in the first place.
We can debate this all day.
No, we can't.
Because it's not a matter of not starting it. I think it's a matter of how you structure your deal. And your deal allows you to get the revenue to the point that revenues are generated, recognize that startups, there's no revenue at the initial part of it. I created a public-private partnership when I was at FTA, and we structured that primarily to allow innovation, but at the same time recognizing that after a point in innovation, when you have a spinoff of a developing firm, that revenues start to generate, and you should therefore start sharing in those revenues at that time. So there are ways, in fact, to do that.
Not disagreeing with you, and that's exactly what I'd like to see us get to. I did have actually another question. On the last slide, you had talked about the use of the system to enhance on-time performance and reduce bunching. Do you have you know, metrics that you're using that enable you to say, well, this is what it was before, here's where it is now, and here by using this, you know, will you be able to track improvement or lack thereof?
We should be able to track that. The issue is we're not sure what that report is going to look like that we're asking for from NextBus, because this is these are items that we're asking them to give us. So we'll be working with them to design what the reports should look like so that we can trend. So yes, the answer is yes, we will ask for that.
Okay, well, I mean, it seems to me that this is a reasonable use of this system that you've been talking about all along. But to know whether it's doing that, you're going to have some way to have measured, you know,
exactly,
the base case before, after, during, and see those trends. And I'd be interested in seeing how that works and what you're able to find once you actually have this systematized.
Right. So, yes, we will do that.
Any further discussion or questions on NextBus? If not, thank you very much, Ms. Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll move on to item E, which is elevator and escalator maintenance. Mr. LaFosse?
Good morning. I'm here today to provide the board with an update on the Office of Elevators and Escalators and the status of some of our major programs. Since 2004, the Office of Elevators and Escalators has doubled our in-house maintenance portfolio. In 2004, Ellis Maintenance Department was responsible for 118 elevators and 231 escalators, covering approximately 750 square miles of the WMATA service area. Over the last 5 years, our in-house maintenance responsibility has expanded to 265 elevators and 533 escalators, and we are on track to assume in-house maintenance of the entire system in July of 2010. This in-house maintenance program has increased our control over cost and schedule by reducing overtime and eliminating contractor markup on labor and parts. In order to successfully develop the program, Metro focused on training. Today, our workforce is comprised of 129 journeymen and 20 apprentices. To date, the program has produced 60 additional journeymen, including 17 who completed the program this month. The improved training was fueled by a $1.5 million state-of-the-art training lab, which opened in 2006, and training programs were developed and registered with the D.C. Department of Labor to create a formal apprentice training program. We will always have trainees filtering through the program, but as the major need to expand our workforce decreases, the resources will refocus on developing refresher training to keep our present workforce current with the new technologies. In addition, we've developed a partnership with Cardozo High School, funded by the district, to develop talent and interest in Metro. There are approximately 60 students a year in this program, and the program focuses on electromechanical skills, electrical engineering design, electronics, and transportation. We also use our training facility in cooperation with Metro's Office of Emergency Management to provide emergency training to our first responders. Our program addresses the constant maintenance and repairs necessary to keep our aging equipment running and includes preventative maintenance procedures, inspections, and repairs. In addition, all accidents and incidents require inspection prior to returning the unit to service. To extend our equipment's life cycle, a capital improvement program includes spending in the order of $25 million annually to rehab or rehabilitate our oldest units to gain an additional 20 years of use, extending the 30-year design life to approximately 50. The CIP program refurbishes 15 elevators and 30 escalators annually, and to date, we have rehabilitated 259 escalators and 75 elevators. Most of our entrance escalators have been completed, and we are now focusing on internal units and platform units. We are also joining forces with the infrastructure renewal program and combining our elevator escalator rehabs with the Red Line and Orange Line rehab projects. This work includes replacing three O&K escalators, adding a staircase and a canopy at Foggy Bottom, and replacing three APV Baker escalators at the DuPont Circle station. This shows the escalator rehab projects that are currently in progress. We are also committed to improving the safety and reliability of our elevators and escalators. We focus on solutions to our most persistent problems. We have developed design enhancements for our comb plate switches, our handrail drives, belts, step axles, and rollers. These components, when combined, are responsible for about 60% of our unplanned outages. As these enhancements are incorporated into the equipment through rehabs and repairs, we will see an improvement in our performance. We have also updated our equipment design criteria and specifications to keep pace with APTA guidelines, code updates, and new technology. This new criteria is currently included in the Dulles projects. We are also working with procurement to identify and qualify alternate sources for some of our hard-to-get components. This has reduced lead time for the O&K, APV, Baker, and Montgomery parts. We are currently working on alternate sources for some of our Fujitech equipment. Our program also focuses on communication with our passengers. A board resolution in 2006 emphasized the importance of communicating information to our passengers, and currently the outage information is provided through signs placed on or near the units, information in the passenger display systems, station intercom announcements, email and text message alerts to our Ellen subscribers, and through our website. We are also preparing to roll out a new sign design, as you can see over here on the A-frame, which will show the information in a little different format and hopefully give our customers a little bit more information on what is actually happening. What you see here, the background yellow, will be used for major repairs. There's also a similar sign with a white background that will be used to announce maintenance work, and a sign with a blue background will be used to announce rehabilitation work.
Okay.
providing over 2 million safe vertical trips a day is the number one priority for our program. Some of the methods we employ to increase elevator and escalator safety include our Smart Ride campaign posters, which are displayed throughout the system on platforms and in rail cars and remind customers about escalator safety. We also use station intercom announcements to remind our customers of safety. We have upgraded lighting in some of our dark areas to increase visibility on the escalators. And during Escalator Safety Week, which occurs in November, staff volunteers distribute safety brochures throughout the system. Volunteers also deliver a program called Safety Ride in area public schools. For the convenience of our wheelchair patrons, we have designed an auto dispatch feature for two-stop elevators. With this feature, there is no need to push a button inside the car. The car automatically goes to the next floor. And in the event an accident does occur, we have relationships with Arlington County DLLR in Maryland and a brand new relationship with DCRA in DC, which allows us to rapidly respond and investigate the accident, which shortens the time the unit is ultimately out of service. The success of Metro's elevator escalator program is recognized by APTA and the other nation's transit agencies as one of the industry's best practices. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Questions?
Sure. The point was just raised with me whether or not our size there meet ADA requirements due to the size of the fence. Might want to check that out to make sure that we are doing so.
Other questions?
Yes. Mr. Jobb. What's the average length of time our elevators are out of service, and is that length of time moving and improving?
The average length of time is not a number that I have in my head. What we usually track is how many are out, and on average, we have 45 units out of service, and there has been a slight increase in that over the last year. It's gone.
And 45 number represents what percentage of your total elevator?
In terms of escalators, it represents about 6.5-7%.
And so you don't know the time frame it takes to repair, the average time frame it takes to
repair? Well, the average for a rehab, a rehabilitation, it takes anywhere from 10 to 18 weeks. It depends on the scope of work. An average repair, and again, it's all relevant to the scope of work, but I would say on average, if a unit is out for a repair, it's probably out in the order of 3 to 4 weeks. And the other calls are usually handled as soon as we can get there. They're out for maybe a few hours.
Do you know if the downtime has improved since you've brought the repair function back in-house?
The downtime, which is a reflection of our availability, has gone up slightly over the last year.
So are there any benefits, any real tangible? You said there's cost savings and some moderate efficiencies, but to the customer, are there any tangible benefits that they see from you bringing the repair service back in-house?
Tangible benefits that the customers see right now, it should be transparent.
I'm not sure I understand what I mean.
The customers shouldn't see any difference between.
So there's no real improvement from bringing the service back in-house.
Well, there are improvements on the cost side, and we are working on getting the availability as best we can. But there are always issues.
I suppose that savings on the cost side translates into keeping our fares or not an increase in our fares. So here's the benefit. I'm making the benefit.
That must be something.
There are other benefits.
There's got to be something else. I'm finding it.
I'm trying to find it.
Good chair.
respond a little bit, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
There is a benefit that you just mentioned. Thank you for that one. But there are other benefits, too. Our teams are able to respond much quicker because they're on, they're within house. The majority of the issues that we have, again, is the triggering of the safety switches. Mm-hmm. And if when the services were all provided from an external source, it took them a while to get there. Our staff are throughout the system, and they can instantly respond. So we're able to respond and get those escalators back up earlier. I will ask them to do some analysis for a period of time, but that is a benefit that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Jankola.
Yeah, thank you. That was what my question was going to be. I mean, how much quicker? I mean, you talked about a lower cost for contracting it out, but you're talking about other benefits, and the question is, how much quicker is it? So, it would be nice to see that analysis. And it sounds to me, over the years, haven't we gone outhouse, in-house several times?
In the past, I mean, I'm not too familiar with the history.
Use the word of outhouse here.
I mean, which is why I only chose to report from 2004 onward, because that's my experience. Yes, we were all in-house, and then in, like, the mid-90s, we've concentrated on contracting, and somewhere before 2004, the decision was made to bring it all in-house, and that's where I came on board.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Graham?
Yeah, I'm very pleased, of course, about the academy at Cardozo High School. How many Cardozo High School graduates have we actually hired into Metro Lamont?
It's somewhere in, I want to say around 3 have been hired into Metro.
Over a period of 2 or 3 years?
That I'm not certain.
Well, let me request that information, so you can provide it to me in writing.
Yes, we will.
Thank you. Any further?
All right, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bring us to our last item, the City-Year Secret Shopper Program.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and that will be presented by Jeff Franco.
Okay. And Mr. Graham, did you want to read this? I think you're responsible for this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased with this effort, and this was funded by the council under my authorship, and it had operated for a period of a year. We're not sure just exactly what's going to happen from this point forward, but I thought it would be useful for the board to have still another report on what has been observed by those who would not have been immediately apparent as observers, and what their report is on the effectiveness and the quality of our services. So, Jeff, I very much appreciate you being here, and we're anxious to hear your report. If you could, in the interest of time, since our board meeting must begin at 11 o'clock, I would suggest that you focus to a considerable extent on your findings.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember Graham, and to the WMATA board. Appreciate your time this morning. My name is Jeff Frank. I'm Executive Director of City of Washington, D.C. I'm going to do a quick presentation on the Secret Shopper program that we did this year in partnership with WMATA.
Good morning. My name is Katie Whitehouse. I'm 23 years old. I'm from Victoria, Texas, and I'm a core member at City of Washington, D.C. City-Year unites 17 to 24-year-olds in a year of full-time service to act as tutors, mentors, and role models to the children of Washington, D.C. Last year, I served at Brown Education Campus in Northeast D.C. in Ward 5. Every day, in order to get to Brown, I boarded the Red Line to Union Station and then boarded the X2 bus to go into Northeast D.C. Each week, I completed a survey along with 100 of my other core members in order to detail our experiences on Metro, which Jeff will talk more about now.
Great. Thank you, Katie. Katie's one of our 100 core members that work for City Year. So as Councilmember Graham alluded, we had a partnership this year, a $150,000 grant through the DC City Council to work with WMATA in doing a Seek a Shopper program. Our core members, 100 of them, travel on the rail and bus lines every day to the school systems that they work in within DCPS. And so in exchange for getting the grant, we had our core members do weekly surveys for WMATA, tally the information, aggregate the information, and presented it to WMATA to, you know, analyze and to do what they thought was fit with it. So the program began on February 1st. Not only were they doing the surveys, they also became safety ambassadors. WMATA trained our core members on different safety procedures through WMATA and on the metro and bus system, so they actually became another set of eyes and ears WMATA could have access to as they traveled through the system. And we took the information, the surveys, and we tallied them into an online tool and aggregated the data. So again, in the interest of time, I'm going to go to the next slide and give you some information on the findings that we found with the program. You can go to the next slide, please. So I think that the main takeaways I want to really bring out here, this is just an example of some of the results that we came up with, but the information that we tallied was really narrowed down not only to the line or bus they were taking, but the actual bus number or car of the metro line they were on, so that the information, if you look at, for example, the vehicle conditions, 7.2% were deemed unacceptable by the core members that filled the survey out. You could actually track that back all the way to the particular car that they were on. If you look at the next slide, the mechanical conditions, again, this is on safety issues, really not subjective information that you're looking at, the same type of information. If the pull cord wasn't working, you can look back at the data that we have. Again, this is all aggregated. We can go specifically to the data in terms of what car or what driver this is referring to. And then on the next slide, again, shows one with safety performance. So this is just one example in terms of Curry's behavior. We were also tracking if an operator was on their cell phone, if one of the survey folks said that they ran a red light. So we can actually track down to the bus driver themselves. So this is a quick snapshot of what we looked at during the course of the year. If you go to the next slide, we are planning on holding a roundtable with WMATA to actually go into more detail on what came from the surveys that we put together this year. We did a total of 1,700. And we're hoping that this was a win-win situation, not only for us, because our core members have to use the bus and rail lines in order to travel to the schools that they work in, but hopefully for WMATA as well, and that we have these 100 core members that are traveling throughout the system, that they can act as eyes and ears for WMATA, but also be safety ambassadors for the system as well. You go to the next slide, please. So this alludes to the partnership. As of right now, this was a grant from DC City Council, from Councilmember Jim Graham. All earmarks were discontinued this year because of budgetary concerns. It is our hope, certainly my hope, that WMATA would find particular interest in us continuing this program and find ways that we can to continue funding it so we can continue doing it this year, to also enhance the survey. The survey was created by WMATA, so we have ideas, I'm sure they do as well, in terms of how we can expand or enhance the surveys that we've been filling out. So it has been beneficial for us to take the metro and the bus route, hopefully beneficial for WMATA as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Do I understand that this is essentially a sampling of what was in the overall survey instrument?
It's just a sampling, correct.
There were a large number of factors you were looking at and evaluating.
A number of different ones. It was a survey that was a one-page survey that was created by WMATA that we had our core members filling out each week.
Okay. And I trust that we could see the whole thing.
Yes.
And that staff is undoubtedly looking at it now.
Yes.
I'd be interested in getting a more comprehensive look offline at, you know, what was evaluated. As you noted, some of these things are objective, some of them are somewhat more subjective. I was going to ask you how it was designed, but you answered that, I guess, that WMATA was involved in the instrument. So presumably it related to things that we were tracking anyway in our previous program.
Yes.
And so we might have some kind of basis for comparing. Because one of the issues with this is, you know, any one survey is nice, it's some absolute number, but what you really need is to see, you know, how things are, what you're showing over time, and get feedback to the organization for how we can make improvements. So can this be used with the work that was done the previous year to
Yes, well, Mr. Chairman, first, I'd just like to commend the organization. I think they did an outstanding job. They gave us honest feedback. And when they saw issues, they told us what they were. But they also were an extension of the organization from the standpoint of presence within the system looking for issues. So I hope at some point in time we can figure out a way to continue this. But to answer your question, yes, we can take this data and make a comparison to data that we collect with our staff and compare that to data that we received from the SHOPPA program that we had earlier this year, and then come up with, you know, what are the differences, what are the similarities, and see if there is a consistency to the process.
Did any of the factors that were evaluated include communications issues, from things ranging from signage to dealings with station managers?
I'm going to have to ask, yes, gentlemen, I don't off the top of my head on that one.
No.
There's so many different surveys.
There was a question about whether a sign was functional and accurate, but other than that, no.
Okay. And we didn't have anybody, you know, report on interactions with station managers, for instance, seeking information or anything like that.
Other than the courteous behavior question, and it all it says is courteous behavior, yes or no.
And whenever a core member filled in actual comments on the survey, we also enter that into the system as well. But again, this could be ideas in terms of how to enhance a survey.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, let me add my thanks to Mr. Kados for your partnering with us to do this, and I hope we'll be able to make some good use and learn more about what we need to do in the future. Ms. Hewlett.
Yeah, I had a question, too, about the first of all, thank you very much, and thank you, Kate, and thank you for thank the other 99 core members who have been very helpful. It's also it's valuable input and feedback, but it's also cultivating another generation of responsible transit users, so that it's great. It does seem like it's win-win. And I know you said you're going to be having a meeting to provide this feedback. I don't know who the meeting is with, and so I'd be curious about that and looking at the report as well, the full report. And when you talked about communications, what about the announcements at the stations, the train operator announcements at the stations? That wasn't in there either?
No, ma'am.
Okay. But you said that, if I understood you correctly, you said people made notes on the things that they observed that may not have been actually part of the study.
Right. I don't think there wasn't a particular place for comments, but some core members voluntarily put comments on it anyway, so we entered that into the system.
It was a pet peeve to make mine in particular, to make sure that all these announcements are audible so that people understand where they are. Yeah. So anyway, I think this was win-win. I thank you for this effort, and I thank Council
Chair Mr. Gincola.
Yeah, is this a national program?
CityEar?
Yeah.
It is. We're in 19 different cities. CityEar Washington, D.C. has been here for about 10 years.
Okay.
And we have similar partnerships with other metro boards in other cities. Boston, for example, we have the same type of safety ambassador program.
All right, you've talked about being safety ambassadors. I'm not sure what that means. How do you define being a safety ambassador? Did you actually help people with some safety issues? Or, I mean, how do you define that?
Well, Kate can speak to what they did in terms of on the bus or rail, but WMATA gave us a few-hour morning session where they talked about different safety procedures. The ones we always remember is the ones where if you fall on the rails to roll underneath the cement awning of the track.
That means you learned about it. But I mean, the question is, what does that mean to be an ambassador, which means you're out there interacting with people? I'm just not sure what you did in that regard.
I don't know if they took any proactive action with any of the customers.
So personally, no. I didn't help anyone roll underneath the of the track. But I think just knowing that there are, you know, 100 extra people out there who have this information that not necessarily the general public has is a nice thing for WMATA, a benefit to WMATA.
So a covert ambassador rather than
secret ambassadors.
Secret.
Other questions, comments?
Well, again, thank you very much. It sounds a great program, and I hope you benefit from it, and I hope we'll find ways to benefit from it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman, I have a motion I'd like to make. I move that the board meet immediately in executive session to discuss personnel matters consistent with Board Procedure Roman numeral 6C, and that we thereafter convene with any business that we have transacted in that board meeting in that executive session to the board meeting, which will begin immediately following our executive session.
Is that an appropriate motion for this committee to take?
Well, I just thought that since we're all here.
Right. Should I adjourn the meeting and then have you make that convening as well? Okay. Sorry. So that will conclude the committee. I'm going to adjourn and hand the gavel over to Mr. Graham, who's convening the board immediately.
I ask that my previous comments be incorporated into this motion. I so move.
Second.
It's your meeting now, so you have to call the vote.
Oh. I called to order this meeting and make the motion that I previously described.
I second the motion.
Is there further discussion? Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No, the ayes have it. Thank you.
Yes.